Sears, with that iconic catalog and ubiquitous stores, has been a household name in the U.S. for 130 years and has held a special place for many people right here in Illinois.
Sears offered Americans the opportunity to realize the dream of the middle class in an affordable way. And beyond that, Sears was a good place to work.
But online shopping and big box stores hit department stores hard, and Sears continues to lose billions of dollars. The future of the retail giant looks grim. We'll talk about the rise and fall of Sears, plus what we know now about how to stop bullying, with a focus on the role students and parents have to play.
Many parents that are listening, you would probably raise some wonderful, respectful kids in your home, but really good kids can engage in mean and cruel behavior. So open the conversation, keep talking, be hypervigilant about it.
And it's Monday. We get the latest in Illinois politics with two political reporters. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. This is the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron in for Nyla Boodoo today. Sears says it's in trouble. It's been losing billions for years now. And a few weeks ago, the parent company, the giant retailer, warned that, quote, substantial doubt exists about the company's ability to survive. It's largely a procedural warning at this point, but it's a stunning moment for an Illinois-based retailer that one analyst credited with democratizing retail in this country. To talk about the rise and fall of Sears, we're joined by James O'Rourke. He's on the line from Indiana. He's a professor of management at the University of Notre Dame, has been following Sears for years now. James, welcome to the 21st. I appreciate you being here.
My pleasure.
And, you know, we'd also love to hear from you out there. What is your memory of Sears? You can give us a call, 800-222-9455, or tweet at us. We're at 21st Show. James, Sears, I mean, unfortunately, being in trouble is not, it isn't a news story. This has sort of been a trend here for a while, but we'll talk a little bit more of that in a minute. But this is a company with an enormous footprint, especially here in Illinois. I know at one point, the country's largest employer. For decades, a name was attached to the tallest building in the world, in the Sears Tower. What did Sears mean to retailing in its heyday?
Well, in so many ways, the company formerly known as Sears Roebuck and Company meant an opportunity for what was essentially a rural or agrarian nation to have access to the same sorts of wonderful goods that were available to people in the big cities. So, excuse me,
And that's that democratizing retail sort of a comment
well,
that we heard
exactly.
earlier.
Well, exactly. You didn't have to get in the car and drive to Chicago or drive to St. Louis or some other large city in order to go shopping. People did that, but the Sears catalog meant that it would be possible to look through and replace something or bolster your wardrobe or order that bicycle for Christmas. And this was something by the 1930s that Americans had really never seen before. There was a time when you could order an entire house from Sears Roebuck and everything you needed in it.
And the tools to build it, too.
Well, exactly. The problem here is one of a failure to adapt. And it isn't just Sears that's at fault here. It's a very large space in the retail market that simply has not adapted as quickly as Americans might have wanted.
Mm-hmm.
The real problem, I think, began in the 1970s, and it involved Sears opening mall stores and stores in urban locations. And the notion was that people won't use the catalog as much as they did, but they'll come to our Sears store because it's in the mall,
mm-hmm.
and that's where people come to shop. That changed really in the 1980s, and by the 1990s, the rise of big box retailers began to eat into Sears sales. Specialty apparel firms were doing much better, and Sears' first step down the hole into oblivion was granting credit to people who were simply not credit worthy.
So it's more than. Let's
the
talk
only
more.
Way to, way to get people into the stores was to make sure that they could shop on credit. And most of the people they gave those cards to were unable to pay back any of those bills.
Okay. So there's a lot to cover there. Before we kind of get to that downfall that you just pointed to there, because that is interesting. It may not be what people think in terms of just being online shopping and things like that. But you took us back to the beginning there, the mail order catalog back in the late 1800s. And what was it that made, and you touched on this a little bit, but what made them so successful for so long as the company that they were?
They could fulfill the brand promise. If you wrote to them and said, I would like very much to order a saw or a hammer, I'd like to order a pair of shoes, they came through for you. They delivered them at the cost advertised. They were good products. They had very good vendors, and everything was guaranteed. No questions asked. You could send them back for a refund or a replacement. And the whole idea that the postman would come to your front door with a new pair of shoes was just astonishing to most people. Sears fulfilled the brand promise and gave Americans the opportunity to live that middle-class dream.
So it kind of represented that vision of middle-class opportunity there. You know, we asked on Twitter, on Facebook, you know, what's your Sears memory here? And Cheryl Ray Stout, who we talked to from time to time, she's a reporter at WBEZ, replied. She said the Sears Christmas catalog, said it was called the Wish Book. You know, we couldn't wait to see it. We're talking obviously about the business side of Sears here, but also some of the, you know, I guess I can call it a nostalgia side. I mean, I was just talking about this show with people around the building here. Everybody kind of had a moment or a story or something, if they sort of fit that Sears target demographic, as me and my family did, actually. We think of the Sears catalog, the back-to-school shopping, the portrait studio, you know, slogans from Sears Has Everything to this jingle from a 1983 ad.
There's more for your life.
So they're just a little taste of some of what we heard in the 1980s for some of us growing up.
That's great. It brings back a lot of memories for a lot of people. Sears at the time was one of the few places on earth where you could walk in and buy doggone near anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you went to an upscale department store, if you were at Neiman Marcus or at another department store, they really focused mostly on apparels and housewares. But Sears, honestly, you could buy a snowblower, a lawnmower, you could buy a set of socket wrenches, you could buy school clothes for the kids. And it was, at the time, I think people thought they were reasonably priced. I think there's something else that may have been overlooked here, and it is those people who worked at Sears. They were people who were our neighbors. They were our friends, our relatives. There's very few people my age right now who didn't know somebody who worked at Sears. And the reason they worked there is that they were good jobs. They were jobs with competitive pay, opportunity for promotion, the opportunity to learn a series of skills, and they came with benefits, health insurance, retirement, you name it. People were proud to say that they were a Sears manager, that they ran the paint department at Sears. They took great pride in that. Those were good jobs.
Especially in Illinois. I mean, I know at one point, not just here, but across the country, I think they said upward of 140,000 people worked for Sears at one point. And I mean, those are the types of jobs, at least in retail, that you often don't see anymore.
No, those are all minimum wage jobs. Now, if you go into a Lowe's or a Home Depot, you may find one person in the department who has both knowledge and skill. The others are still trying to learn on the job. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt. They're there for $7, $8, $9 an hour. There's very little vertical mobility, and the vast majority of them don't have the benefits they require and are probably working a second or a third job. So those kinds of positions have changed dramatically in the last 30 years.
So you've kind of laid out a picture here for us of this company that, you know, built this model, started out as a catalog, was very strong, gave people opportunity and really stood by and represented and had jobs and, you know, kind of pieced together this whole thing. And then you alluded to this shift when things began to change, and now here we are, you know, a statement from the company that basically they can't promise Sears is sustainable anymore in its current form. What happened?
Well, if we go back 30 years, we go back to the 1980s, prior to the internet, the company realized that it was slipping further behind its competitors. It was less profitable. It had fewer innovations. And there was a recognition that there was some difficulty there. So rather than changing its business model in a dramatic way, they doubled down on the old model. And frankly, by the 1990s, they ended up with merchandise which was considered substandard on the soft side. They had great brands on the hard side. Kenmore,
hard side being your appliances and your...
Appliances, tools, you name it. A Craftsman, probably the great American brand in tools. And so they always made money on that side of the house, but they found increasing difficulty as the economy globalized in offering fashionable merchandise at an affordable price. So the one way to get people in the front door was to offer them credit. And excuse me, the idea was you can come in and get whatever you need. You can get clothes for all your kids for back to school. You can come buy a Kenmore washer and dryer, and we'll put it on your Sears revolving charge account. You'll just pay us $28 for the next 6 or 7 years, and eventually it'll be paid off.
Right. I mean, it sounds like a good model. Where did they go wrong?
Yeah. Well, the problem is we can measure credit worthiness out to 5 decimal points. We know exactly what the factors are that lead to failure. A regression analysis shows those kinds of folks who exhibit particular behaviors that indicate they're not going to pay you back. And Sears simply gave credit cards to almost anyone. And they knew it was risky. And therein lies the real problem. They knew what the risk was. And by 1993, when the bankruptcy laws changed in this country, an individual could file for personal bankruptcy pretty easily. One-third of all individuals or families filing for bankruptcy by 1993, one-third of them had a Sears credit account. They were granted bankruptcy protection, and it meant the debts were extinguished. They couldn't be collected, but they were being carried on the balance sheets as an asset. Sears had to write that off. And they also went through a really disturbing period in which they hired private collection agencies to go out and go after these people whose debts no longer existed.
So after they declared bankruptcy, they hired a collection firm to go out and try to get money from them anyway?
Exactly. And they knew it was illegal. External law firms told them so. And they didn't file the reaffirmation agreements with the judges. They failed to do this almost a 500,000 times in all 50 states. And so it's not an oversight. It was written into their collection practices, and the bankruptcy courts were livid. They had to pay back hundreds of millions of dollars to people they had collected it from. And, you know, here was an interesting moment. It had to come with interest as well because they had obtained this illegally. And the Sears attorneys asked what interest rate they should compound that fee with. And the judge, in this case, Carol Kenner in Boston Bankruptcy Court, said, well, it's not the current 6 or 6.5. You will compound that with the rate you charge on your card, which was at the time 21.5.
Wow. So sending a message there, too, that this will not stand.
Well, where do you get that kind of money? It's not coming from current revenues. If you go into the bond market and try to borrow it, you're going to pay outrageous rates. It was a downward spiral at that point. When Alan Lacy became CEO in 2000, there was a moment of hope. He sold all of the collectible debt they had, got out of the credit business, because at that point, credit was 50% of Sears' operating margin. Wow. Half. half of the money they made came from credit.
Just from credit. So, and that's the money from, not from people buying things, but from the money they made from charging those interest rates.
Exactly. And so he famously said at a staff meeting, we can no longer depend on credit to sustain this enterprise. We've got to start behaving like a department store. And, you know, people thought, well, perhaps that'll work. It didn't. Hmm. And buying Land's End was a great move, but it didn't. It wasn't enough.
So what? Now we've got about a minute here before the break or so. But what were some? You mentioned in 2000, kind of that moment of hope. You know, with Lacey there. Were there some things? You know, what were some of those things they did with Land's End and some other things that they tried to change the way that they were doing business at that time?
Well, it was pretty clear they were strong on the power tools and appliances side of the house. They just couldn't get people in the door to look at clothing and fashions, and they had to do something. And buying Land's End from Gary Comer up in Dodgeville, Wisconsin, looked like a really solid move. It was an affordably priced, stylish, almost sort of an Abercrombie in its day, an Eddie Bauer. They offered, I thought, real hope if they managed the merchandising correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, they never did.
Just never did. Well, let's keep talking here. We'll look ahead a little bit more to the business side and some of the things that went wrong. Obviously, this is all happening in the context of online shopping and big box retailers and everything else. And then let's look ahead here a little bit too at the end and talk a little bit more about what may be next for Sears. Talking with James O'Rourke, professor of management at the Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame, talking about the rise and the fall of Sears, one of the iconic brands of Illinois. Stay with us. This is the 21st. It's the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo here today. We're talking about the rise and the fall of Sears. Just a couple of weeks ago, the company warned that in its current form, the business may no longer be sustainable. Sort of a procedural warning there they made clear, and they said that they do have a plan to take the company forward. But the first time that we have heard strong language like that from the company itself. On the line, we have James O'Rourke, professor of management at Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame, been following Sears and the company for a long time, and is with us there on the line from Indiana. You know, just before the break here, you were talking about that moment of hope back in 2000. The company was picking up Land's End, trying to get a little bit stronger on the clothes and the brands and sort of those softer kind of goods that you were talking about. You know, looking back, I mean, the shift that you were talking about after the 1990s with the credit card problems that they got into, Was this inevitable, I guess, or did Sears miss an opportunity to maybe go back to those catalog roots, you know, and in some ways and adapt to online shopping in a different kind of landscape?
Well, two things happened. One is that there was pretty clear mismanagement of the firm. The bets they put down did not work, and the people they hired to do merchandising really didn't have a feel for the market. So that's issue number one. Issue number two is that the market was moving on. It was changing. And what I would say to you now is if you walk into a Sears today, many customers would simply say, you know, I can do better. I can get better products, better looking merchandise at a better price. And it's really easy to comparison shop. I was a student at the University of Cambridge in the 1970s, mm-hmm. and Charles Darwin was a graduate of the college that I had attended. And the lesson of Charles Darwin and the Origin of Species is not survival of the fittest. The lesson is adaptation to a changing environment ahead of the requirement for it. And Sears simply did not see any changes in the market. There are plenty of companies who didn't see that. Montgomery Ward, certainly a good example. There are plenty of others. H.H. Gregg just filed for liquidation last week. There are plenty of brands that are no longer around. If you're old enough, you may even remember the brand Smith Corona. My students think of a beer. I say, no. That's Grupo Modelo. It's a Mexican beer company. The Smith Corona brand was absolutely the global leader in manual typewriters. But they didn't foresee desktop computing. And so the question really here for visionary chiefs is, how fast do I have to change and in which direction do I have to go? With the rise of the internet, with the rise of cellular telephones with cameras so that you could do comparison shopping, the term often used is showrooming. Where can I get the same product at a better price? Can I order it online? The rise of a retailer such as Amazon, who will put exactly what you want at your doorstep in 48 hours at a really good price, really means there's no incentive to get in the car and go into the inner city or out to the mall and shop at a Sears.
Yeah.
Now, I would say two other things about department stores. One, the folks at the top are making money. Nordstrom, Bloomingdale's, Neiman Marcus.
Your higher-end brands.
Taylor. Yeah. The folks at the bottom are struggling a bit. Walmart, Target, Kohl's, Meijer. But they're making money, and they've got a good brand promise. They have a good business model. Folks in the middle, JCPenney, I would predict the very same thing for them. I think Macy's is in considerable trouble. And, you know, I think anyone who's still mad about Marshall Field, put me on that list, thinks that Macy's is getting what they deserve. They're closing 200 stores this year.
So you look at this company, and they've got, you know, it is a different company. It is now part of a holding company. It is now joined with Kmart as of the mid-2000s or so. A new CEO kind of, you know, leading things here. What's do they still see a plan forward? Does Sears have a path forward?
If they do, they certainly haven't shown it. The CFO said on the 28th of last month when they filed their SEC 10-K, the annual report, we have a turnaround plan in place. This is all going to work. Nothing to worry about. Well, that required statement about substantial doubt the company can survive is there because it's true. It's required. They have enough money for another 90 to 120 days, no question. They may have enough to get through the end of the year, and they may be able to put some assets together to get through the Christmas season. But it's an unsustainable enterprise. If you look at the balance sheet, you see, for example, negative top-line revenues, meaning folks coming in the front door. They're losing money on that. Their costs exceed their revenues. Even more important, their other large revenue source has been from the sale of assets, and those are negative numbers. In other words, they were carried on the books for more money than they actually got when they sold them. They've sold Land's End. They've sold Craftsman. There isn't much else. That's an unsustainable strategy. They're down to real estate.
I see. So just a slow liquidation of what was a pretty grand company here. At one point, it sounds like
big companies take a long time to die.
Yeah, just a matter of time. You know, one last question. We've only got about a minute left here. But, you know, with all that we've talked about, we started out with a little bit of, you know, nostalgia, I guess, at the beginning, just reminiscing this company and what it was and what it meant to Illinois and specifically. What's lost with if Sears does go away? I mean, what's obviously the jobs and things like that on the business side, but is something more lost, or has the industry, has the business changed so much that it's just one more story in a textbook somewhere?
Well, it's a way of life. We have to move on. Our children and our grandchildren have to accept the marketplace has changed. We go about gathering our goods and services in a very different way. But I'll tell you, my real hope is entrepreneurs. I look at this fellow who has begun, Chobani. He came from nothing. He had nothing but a yogurt recipe in his pocket. He now employs tens of thousands of people, and this has all happened in just a few years. I think that the real hope is entrepreneurs and people with a good idea who will find some financial backing
and drive things forward. Well, James O'Rourke, thank you very much. I appreciate your time, professor of management at University of Notre Dame, and looking at and teaching about Sears for a long time. Thank you very much.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to talk next here about what we know about how to stop bullying. It's a conversation we started last month with a focus on what Illinois schools are doing to address and prevent bullying. But that's only one part of the problem and the solution. Today we're going to talk about the role that parents and students can play in preventing bullying. And we're joined on the line from Chicago by Colleen Cicchetti, clinical psychologist, executive director of Lurie Children's Center for Childhood Resilience. Colleen, thanks for being with us. I appreciate your time.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
So, you know, I know you spend quite a bit of time working with coaching counselors and parents who are dealing with bullying. What are you seeing out there these days?
Well, you know, I think that the first show you had was really great at recognizing that bullying has been a pretty consistent issue across many generations, but we are definitely seeing some swings where we're recognizing, I think adults in particular, recognizing that the impact of bullying is more significant than we realized. And so I think it's being taken much more seriously, as well as there are new mediums for which bullying to occur, which is largely through technology. So there's the old-fashioned bullying that probably has always existed that's continuing, and then there's also some new ways for this to get even worse or for kids to have trouble separating from that kind of challenge.
And so that's some things that we've learned about causes may not be the right, but the ways that bullying happens. What sorts of things have we learned about teaching kids not to bully?
Well, I think, you know, as we've talked about in many conversations and you talked about last time, is we can't just go in and tell kids what not to do.
Mm-hmm.
Just we've learned in many different strategies that just say no to drugs, just say no to bullying, just say no to sex, all of those strategies do not work. And what we really need to think about as adults is how do we invest the energy, the training for our professionals, and the resources to building kids' capacity to treat each other well. And so that's a lifelong learning process that starts in the families and moves through adulthood with the support and guidance of teachers and educators, but also faith leaders and community settings and certainly parents.
So what are some of the specific things then that you tell people to do or that you advise, you know, if folks are having these conversations, where do you begin?
Well, I think it's really critical to start with some of the, you know, there is a really important place to start the conversation of what we do and do not expect out of each other in terms of how we treat one another. So if we're talking about, you know, the broad terminology we use is social-emotional functioning, and there are social-emotional learning strategies which really cover things like recognizing your own emotions, recognizing how other people feel, being able to do some social problem solving. All of those are skills that we actually have some guidelines in our state, and you can look on the ISBE website and see what kids should be learning. But I also think it's really critical that while we're also teaching those skills, that we're thinking about if kids are having challenges learning those skills, where does that come from? Is it that we need to be doing it more often and teaching them what to do? Is it how we're modeling what they're seeing in the environment around them? Social behavior really does occur in a social context. And the first place that we learn social behavior is in our own families. And then over time, as we grow and develop, the world that has an impact on us grows. So when we're little kids, it's our relationship with our parents and our siblings and cousins, and then it moves into the preschool and the kids on your block, and that's a world. And then it's your school, but then it's really, you know, your community and then the broader culture. So we really have to be thinking about, are we reinforcing, teaching respect in a developmental way for all kids across that continuum?
So I think, you know, if I've got, you know, maybe a 10, 11, 12-year-old in middle school or something like that, and, you know, a lot of times at that age, kids, you sit down and have a serious conversation. You know, it may go in one ear and out the other. They might be trying to read a comic book while they're doing it or picking up an iPad or something. You know, as for parents, I mean, how do you begin this kind of a conversation? How do you sit down and start? Or is that the wrong way to go about it? Do you need to sort of go in through the side door instead?
I think those are great questions. I think a couple of things. I think one piece is, if we think about the social relationships, it's those conversations. You know, I mean, it's really the what happened today at school, who are you hanging out with, who are your friends, what is it like in the lunchroom, is there anyone at school who's being mean to you, is there anyone you don't like, why not? So, you know, asking specific questions, parents tend to say, how was school, mm-hmm. and they get this one word, kind of grunt, depending on how old
okay.
the kid is, right? Yeah, okay, right, depending on their age, and especially if they're distracted. So I usually try, when I'm talking to parents about having difficult conversations or having regular conversations, I talk about really more specific questions. I think the other place, you know, so there's the regular how do we treat each other questions, yeah. and I think those conversations can start at the very, you know, earliest age. You know, who are your friends? You know, what happened at school today? Did someone do something that you really liked? How do you show that? You know, I do, when my girls were little, we used to do highs and lows of the day at dinner time, and you get to a lot by just saying, you know, what was the best thing that happened to you today? What was the worst thing that happened to you today? And parents and kids having that conversation together. And so kids also then start to see that social behavior is a challenge all the way through, but that if you have sort of good sort of general rules around how do you want to be treated yourself and you can talk about it, that's a way to sort of introduce it. And remembering that when kids are younger, they're much more interested in our opinions than as they get older. Right. They still are going to want to hear them, but those early years, especially like, you know, little kids, 2 to 6 or 7, they're really asking for our approval and our interest. So those kinds of conversations, using things like, you know, Sesame Street or other places to kind of introduce those concepts, can be powerful. And then as they get older, recognizing that there's a very clear awareness of peer expectations. So then it's really a good time for parents to be engaging in those conversations with, well, what kinds of adults are my kids interacting with? What are the rules like in the soccer team, at the Girl Scout program, at the, you know, at the basketball team, in my school? Are the adults engaging with my kids kind of doing what I want them to do?
So you're kind of
all of that goes over sort of a developmental spectrum of how do we teach kids the appropriate ways to treat one another.
And then, of course, that modeling that you're talking about before, you're kind of laying out here and describing, you know, setting almost a baseline. So you're not just watching for a red flag and then jumping in there and trying to have a conversation, but you're establishing an open communication from the beginning. And then what types of things do you look for? I mean, what sort of, are there subtle changes? Are there red flags that as you have these conversations with, you know, with your kids that might make your ears perk up?
Yeah, no, definitely it is a baseline phenomenon of getting that conversation opening, having kids understand that they can come home and talk with you about things and that you want to know is the number one thing. Because one of our, you know, in terms of bullying, one thing we know is that the last person that most kids will tell is an adult, because they don't actually think the adults are taking it seriously, or they don't think that they know how to help. So if they're going to be talking, they're likely to be talking to their peers. So it's really critical that that foundation is laid down for parents. And then I think what you're looking for are some, you know, some guidelines in terms of how they're interacting with their peers socially, in terms of, you know, has there been a change in their friendship? Do they feel comfortable? Is there someone at school? One of our best protective factors is having one really good friend. Is there someone who they know has their back? Are there adults in school that they know that they could go to if there is a problem? Is it safe to bring up what's going on? Are there periods during the day where they can bring up issues and do some social problem solving in the classroom? If this classroom is using a social emotional learning curriculum, then, you know, knowing that and having those teachers send home information about how they're talking to your students so that you can then reinforce that kinds of thing could be important. But we certainly look for changes. You know, if they start withdrawing more, they're spending less time. Let's say they used to spend a lot of time on the video or on their phones, and now all of a sudden they're not wanting to, or they're not wanting to go to activities they previously used to like. You might see changes in appetite, changes in sleep. So signs of sort of distress generally you're wanting to be looked for, as well as those sort of social changes.
And you mentioned some of the technology both earlier and just now, you know, and there are certainly things that can pop up in that way. I'd like to talk about that a little bit more. We're just coming up on a short break here, but talking with Colleen Cicchetti, clinical psychologist, executive director of Lurie Children's Center for Childhood Resilience, talking about bullying and what parents and students can do specifically and what to watch out for. A couple more minutes here after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. We're talking with Colleen Cicchetti, clinical psychologist, the Lurie Children's Center for Childhood Resilience. We're talking about bullying and what students, what parents can do to prevent it, to stop it, to communicate with their children and keep an eye out for red flags. You know, and Colleen, one of the things we were just talking about is technology and the use of, you know, apps and social media. There's now chat rooms and games and everything where people can communicate and interact, and it opens up a lot of opportunities. But these are also different things than a lot of parents grew up with themselves. Their kids now have access to. How does that change sort of the dynamic and the challenge of all this?
I think it's a really important challenge because I think, first of all, there's challenges in the level of supervision of social relationships that we don't have when kids are on the internet or on their phones. We're seeing a lot of peer-to-peer sort of practices that are not engaging adults. So we know that kids have, almost every middle schooler has a phone. We know that many parents are not checking on their kids' social media usage or spending time with them. And in many cases, parents are sort of a little intimidated. You know, you think you've got one, you learn how to use Facebook, and then they moved on to Snapchat or they moved on to another one. So we're seeing that there's this kind of access to technology that's really intense. And one of the things that does is it makes it harder for that child to separate. So if they're having peer issues at school, coming home used to be a safe haven. But now coming home, having the phone in your pocket means that those same behaviors in terms of taunting and, you know, meanness and other kinds of social rejection, exclusivity, all of that can be happening in their pocket.
So there's no escape from it.
There's no escape, exactly. And kids need a break from that. So one of the first things that I often tell parents, in addition to talking about, you know, some rules about the phone, but one of them is actually forcing them to take a break. I think it's, you know, especially with younger kids, when one of the things I like to think about is the analogy of a car. There's a lot of privilege that comes with a cell phone, but there are certainly a lot of risks. And so I do really think it's critical for parents, when they introduce a cell phone to a child, to build up that child's capacity to manage this very powerful tool. You know, you wouldn't just hand over your keys to your car and say, go for it. And yet we hand them over these phones with all kinds of capacity, more capacity on the phone than my computer in graduate school. And we tell kids, you know, make good decisions. So I think part of it is that, you know, as they introduce this type of technology, parents need to really be thinking about, how do I support my child in using this amazing resource, but in a way that they are developmentally able to handle it. And so from the get-go, setting expectations about checking their emails or their cell, you know, looking at their texts, talking to them about how we talk to one another, helping them understand that what you do and say on a cell phone can be passed along to anyone and you have no control over that. And I really suggest that, you know, those kinds of conversations really have to happen right from the beginning. I'll say something really concrete, like, anything that you write in a text, how would you feel if I walked up to your school and it was in 6-foot letters written in front of the school, or your grandmother were to read it?
Yeah, so you know, you're giving them, increasing their capacity to be able to use these tools, then building trust maybe a little bit too, that they can, you know, use this responsibly while also monitoring and using some of the electronic tools and things. You know, I wanted to ask, you know, one more question here. You brought it up a little bit earlier about talking about modeling and making sure that the examples that children see out there of what's going on in the world. And I just think, to, you know, recent months we've seen examples of messages of hate, you know, graffiti of different things, swastikas posted in schools and universities and things, you know, combined with some messages that some think it's okay to use that kind of language and things like that. How much harder is it right now to tell kids not to bully at a moment when they may be seeing a very different message out there?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The political rhetoric has been very difficult, and there has been a lot of modeling. I mean, we've heard even adults talk about how they can no longer go on Facebook because they are saying mean things to one another. I mean, so we've created a context where it seems like there's more disrespect being supported, or at least looked over and not, you know, being addressed in our culture. And again, that's where that social cultural context comes in. And I think that what we really have to do is be mindful of that. If we are doing things like having anti-bullying programs and social emotional learning curriculums in our schools, but our kids are still acting in those ways, how are we revisiting those sort of golden rules of treating others the way you want to be treated? And how are we modeling respect for differences and how we can learn if there's someone that we don't understand? You know, I definitely have heard the rumors of, you know, much more stress going on in terms of kids being targeted for differences in the last few months, and we've been trying to be responsive to that. but I've also seen the yard signs that say, you know, love is for everyone. And, you know, I mean, so you're seeing communities, I think, and adults maybe being re-brought into the conversation. And it's a little harder to say this is the school's responsibility. And that's really one of my rules of thinking is that social behavior, if it comes in from a social context, we have to look at that peer context and do everything we can to teach and reinforce and not just do that lesson once a week on Mondays, but to make it a part of our culture and the school climate. But we also have to look at how we are modeling that for the adults in our lives and how we're talking about people, what kind of language we're using. Is there a space and a place to express differences, but also do that in a respectful way?
Yeah. And to draw on, it sounds like also draw on some of those concrete things that we see out there, not ignore them or pretend they're not there, but to find ways to pull in the good and the bad to spark conversation.
And I think there's tools for adults to do that and for parents to have those kinds of conversations. There's also a couple of really just basic things. There's some stuff on, you know, the Attorney General's website, even just some simple contracts that you can get kids to go and say, I will not do, you know, some of these dangerous things, helping them understand the danger of some of this as well. A lot of times kids aren't aware of the fact that, you know, it's a law to do cyberbullying, for example. So there's sort of the very concrete things like, there are students who've sent naked pictures to one another thinking it was funny, and they've ended up, you know, not being able to compete in interscholastic sports.
Yeah,
right?
And
so
I've seen
you've
real
got to kind of go back and forth between, you know, there's real consequences, there's messages of teaching. There's a lot on the Internet, actually. A lot of kids have created a lot of information about safety. So it's safety for your child against the perpetrator, but also the recognition that if they've, you know, kids can do and say mean things on an electronic source because they don't see the impact on the other kid.
Well, Colleen, thank you very much. Colleen Cicchetti, clinical psychologist, executive director of Lurie Children's Center for Childhood Resilience. I appreciate your time. Obviously, much more to talk about here. We'll leave it there for today. Thank you very much. You're listening to The 21st. And every Monday, we bring you the latest in Illinois politics. We're joined again by two political reporters to help us understand what's behind all the headlines we've been seeing here in the past week. Sarah Burnett, politics reporter with the Associated Press, and Dave McKinney, politics correspondent with Reuters Chicago. Sarah, Dave, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Scott.
Sarah, just to start with you here, you know, we're now at 22 months without a full state budget, but who's counting? Last week, the House passed... there's debate over what to call it, a stopgap, a lifeline, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, what would this temporary budget fund and how long, just briefly, would it last? What's the deal with this one?
Right. So the House passed it. It's about $817 million, mostly for social service programs, health programs, and higher education, those areas that have been the hardest hit by what has been happening in the state over the last nearly 2 years.
Okay, and the Senate is on vacation. The governor has said no way. Any odds that this actually goes anywhere?
Well, that's a big question. The Senate, as I'm sure we've all talked about, had its own plan that it was attempting to do, which was a more permanent solution. This, again, is another temporary fix. And the Senate really had positioned itself that they wanted to get a longer-term solution. The governor has taken the position that that's what should happen also. So it doesn't look real promising for this particular piece of legislation. The Republicans argue that if you take away the pressure of what's happening right now, that there will be basically zero motivation to get a full state budget.
Yeah, with a Band-Aid measure or something like that, just... wind up prolonging things in the long run. You know, I wanted to save a few minutes just because there's been a lot of news in recent weeks here on the governor's race. And yes, we're well into election season again. Looking ahead to the governor's election race in 2018, Bruce Rauner are airing ads and doing some visits around the state. Democrats lining up to try and unseat him. Who are we looking at right now in terms of who's? And Dave, let me ask you this one: who's running right now? What are some of the names people are hearing right now?
Well, I mean, it's an expanding field. I mean, even today we have a new candidate who is sticking his toe in the water. So far, we've had J.B. Pritzker, who is the heir to the Hyatt Hotel fortune, Chris Kennedy. He's part of the Kennedy clan, son of Robert F. Kennedy. We have State Senator Daniel Biss from Evanston. We have Chicago alderman Amiya Pawar. And then a couple of other people that have shown some interest, the city treasurer in Chicago, Kurt Summers, and a school superintendent from downstate, Bob Diber. And as I said today, State Representative Scott Drury formed an exploratory committee. So, I mean, we've got a broadening field, and it's so far shaping up as the two guys that seem to have money and name recognition in Pritzker and Kennedy are, I think, the perceived front runners in this field. And then you've got, the flank that is representing the progressive wing of the party and Biss and Pawar and such. And so it is a broadening field. And interestingly enough, a field that so far does not include any women.
Uh-huh, you're right. Not at this point. You know, one of the things that it seems anyway, like let me ask this: are we seeing a message from the Democrats that are lining up at this point? Is there a vision that's being laid out, or are they running essentially right now on the anti-Rauner ticket?
Well, I mean, it's certainly the anti-Rauner ticket is the fresh meat that Democrats want to consume. They across the board, everybody wants to get rid of Rauner. But, what we saw last week, for example, with Pritzker when he made his announcement in Chicago and then did a downstate wing, it just seemed like every place he went, he was, bringing up Rauner and Trump and linking the two of them together and trying to stir up interest that way. They recognize in Rauner probably the nation's most vulnerable incumbent Republican because, his approval ratings are down in the 30s. It's a very a weak position to be in. But again, it's going to, those numbers don't tend to mean a lot until you actually have a real person to match someone up against.
Yeah. Sarah, you wrote a story recently called A Look at the Very Rich Men Running for Illinois Governor. How much more money is going to be spent in this governor's race compared to previous cycles?
Well, I think pretty much every cycle we see increased spending, just sort of naturally. I think depending on how this shakes out, we have the potential to see just almost mind-blowing money being spent. Obviously, Governor Rauner kind of outlined the stakes when he, in December, dropped $50 million into his campaign fund, and the message was clear that that was just getting started, that there was a lot more where that came from. The other two men who were in that story as the wealthy candidates were, of course, J.B. Pritzker and Chris Kennedy. Pritzker, his net worth is somewhere around $3.4 billion. That's considerably more than Rauner or Kennedy. And so the message is out there that these guys have money and can spend it. The Democrats, there's this divide among the Democrats. You've got Biss and Pawar and some other folks who are saying, we shouldn't just be running another rich guy against a rich guy. But there's also this argument that the Democratic Party and a lot of the groups that fund them need to also focus on other races in 2018. They need to either hold on to seats in the legislature or pick up some that they lost in the last election. And so having someone who can self-fund in a governor's race could be helpful to the party.
And we've seen that play out on the Republican side. So, I mean, Governor Bruce Rauner's money has changed the dynamic in a number of races here and sort of helped push forward people and ideas that otherwise may not have. How likely is it? Or are we at all likely to see that happen on the Democratic side?
Well, I think it just depends on how this shakes out. I'm sure there are a lot of Republicans who would argue that happens already.
With unions and other big spenders and things like that.
Sure, sure. I mean, the complaint against Rauner is that he never stopped campaigning. But on the Democratic side, there are other organizations that are doing it, have been doing it nonstop as well, that are big Democratic supporters.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Sarah Burnett, AP Politics reporter Dave McKinney with Reuters Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st, also available on iTunes and Android. I'm Scott Cameron. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.